It's time for Windows Weekly. Mary Jo's got the week off. She's still in Japan, but Paul Theriot is here. We're going to talk about Windows 8. We've got a new version coming out, the release candidate, and there are some big changes, including no more Aero. What? Paul Theriot explains all next on Windows Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Theriot, episode 262, recorded May 24th, 2012. The Dumbening. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup, automatic, continuous, unlimited backup for your computer files, only $59 a year. Try it free at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Windows to get 2 bonus months with purchase. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show that covers all your Windows needs. And I feel terrible. I've been missing a lot of Windows Weekly, and I've been missing, most importantly, the lovely Paul Theriot. And so I'm so glad to be here. Mary Jo is not here again this week. What is she up to, Paul?
She's eating sushi in Japan.
Is she in Japan?
Yeah.
Oh, so jealous. So jealous.
Yep.
She
finally posted some food photos on Facebook. So I said to my wife yesterday, we're going for sushi right now.
Yeah. Doesn't it make you crave sushi? So is this a vacation for her?
Yeah, this is her first vacation in double-digit years. It's been a long
time. I believe
that
with her. I believe that, yeah.
Yep.
She's not she's a hard-working person.
She's not lazy.
No, never would say that. So I'm impressed. Wow, that's great. Good for her.
Yeah.
But she'll be back next week.
Yes.
Meanwhile, it's just like the good old days.
Mm-hmm.
Me, Paul, a cup of coffee.
Let us talk of manly things.
and some Call of Duty. I've been playing
How's the manscaping going, Leo?
Manscaping's going well, I must say. I've been playing Diablo 3 a lot.
Yeah. I have not even looked at that.
Not your kind of game, because it's a top-down, it's not first-person.
Yeah. I used to play Diablo. Diablo 2 was a big deal for me.
Oh, it was a huge... Well, if you like Diablo 2, it's basically Diablo 2.
It was like 20 years ago, so it's kind of hard to say if I'd like it still.
It has been quite a while, more than a decade since it came out. But this one is, it's like more Diablo 2. Mm-hmm. They didn't really reinvent the franchise. There's no reboot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little better. It's prettier. They've got a couple of new classes. The monk class, a lot of fun to play. I'm really enjoying that. It's fun. It's fun. Hmm. I can't stop playing. Let's put it that way. And it's all a Skinner box. I was talking with Tom Merritt because he's also hooked on this.
Yeah.
And it's just a Skinner box. Remember, Skinner was the behavioral scientist who put his children in a box. He started with rats, but he eventually put his children, and it was positive reinforcement. He'd give them treats when they did things he liked. And that's really all this is, because...
Well, that's what Angry Birds is, really, right? I mean, it's just enough to keep you going, kind of.
Yeah, I guess you're right. This is even more like that. You really... maybe this is the difference. You're in a Skinner box and you don't care.
Yeah.
Because you're all the only gameplay is this.
Right.
That's the gameplay.
It's an addiction. And you're addicted when you actually have to go to the doctor because something's wrong with your finger.
Yeah, because carpal tunnel, hello. This is all you do is you tap the mouse because you're just, and occasionally you'll hit a keystroke. Tap, 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 tap. And then what's interesting, you can click and hold, Dwayne? Oh, wow. Wow, my life has changed. So
maybe you could duct tape the button down.
I believe for firing you need to click. He means maybe moving. But anyway, and that's true. For moving you can do that. But there's so much fighting now because I'm in a hairy portion of the game. And then when you kill a monster, stuff pops out of them. They call it the drops.
That was, let me think of a game that used to do stuff like that. There's a similar kind of gameplay style where there are different ways you can make a game harder, right?
Right.
You can do it artificially. When you kill the last monster, all of a sudden more just magically appear.
That's not good.
It's kind of a cheap way of ratcheting up the difficulty level.
I agree.
It's a classic.
Or you could just make the monsters stronger, and they're getting stronger, but...
Or smarter, too.
And smarter. Right. Yeah, because dumb monsters are no good. But then the drops are great because they have
gray drops, which are broken items. They have white drops, which are normal items that have kind of, they're like not worth very much. Mm-hmm. They have green drops. They drop green items, which are magical items. And those are usually worth something. I only pick up magical or better. And then occasionally you get a yellow item, a mystery item. And when you do your magic powers on it, you find out it's like the holy helmet of Thoth. Holy hand grenade. Yeah. And then...
I mean, sometimes it's bad though, right?
No, it's always... It's only been good. You're right. I seem to remember it being different and more complicated in Diablo 2. Like you had to do spells and stuff. But it's just boom. And these yellow things are great. You know, you put on the holy bear thorn bush tree helmet and, you become dynamite. So that's the Skinner box, because basically it's click, 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 and then you have periodic rewards.
Right. Oh, just look. Keep it going.
Yeah. Oh, look.
If it's delicious. Yeah. If it's properly paced, they do this right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And you really know that you're a victim of a psychological experiment. So there you go. And I can't stop playing, even though I know that I'm just a victim of a Skinner box. But that's enough of that. Let's talk about Windows. I'm so sorry.
We've got some more video game stuff to discuss. It's okay.
Well, see, with Mary Jo not here.
I know. That's
why
I'm loading it up.
Can talk about the stuff we really care about. You know what I'm saying?
Like Hotmail.
Hotmail.
A steaming cup of Hotmail.
You know, I saw a number. Boy, this blew my mind. Mm-hmm. I just was stunned.
Yep,
that Windows 8 will have a half billion users by next year, according to Steve Ballmer.
Yeah, except that's not what he actually said, apparently.
Oh.
I'm still waiting on some form of transcript or video of this
headline
from Microsoft. Yeah, yeah. The quote that was provided, actually there was no quote of him actually saying that. The quote that they provided early on was, Windows 8 is certainly the most important piece of work we've done. It's really, in some senses, a dawning of the rebirth of Windows.
Of the rebirth of Windows.
Yeah, which, by the way, is fair enough.
That's too hyperbolistic.
No. I mean, I think that's defensible in the sense that they're recasting Windows as a system that works across tablets and traditional computers, right? So there'll be new types of devices that run Windows 8. We can argue about whether the design is successful or not, but certainly they're going in a completely different direction. So rebirth, whatever, however you want to say it. I mean, I think that's okay. The 500 million thing though, that's interesting. I don't see the update in my article. That's odd. I updated this.
I have the quote that, you put in your,
well, my original article, I wonder if I updated the wrong one. Well, okay. Anyway,
I hate it when that happens. See, you were in a hurry. You said, I don't know if I have time to do this, and you did anyway.
This is on the web, sadly. So, Microsoft had contacted me and said, hey, this isn't exactly what he said. And I said, okay, fine. What did he say? And then they couldn't tell me what he really said. later on, I know.
Was this at a closed event? There were no press?
I guess. It's hard to say because literally there's no transcript or video of it, at least as of the last time I checked.
But somebody was there, or was this? Were they working off the Microsoft release?
Yeah, in my show notes, I have the updated quote where what he's really talking about is Windows generally. And what he's really saying is that between now and the end of next year, 400 to 500 million users are expected to buy Windows-based computers and devices, which is, actually fairly accurate. The notion that somehow 500 million of them would be all Windows 8, it would all be bought between, the end of the year and the end of the next year is far-reaching. You know, that's a bit of a stretch. And what I had written originally was the notion that if he really believes this, I mean, he's putting his reputation on the line, because when they come in under that number, he's going to be criticized very seriously for that.
Does it seem a large number to you, or is that my...
So he also said at the same talk that, and this is a... This,
Did
this
he
is
mean the, all Windows users or yes. just Windows 8?
He meant all Windows.
Oh, well, see, that's not such a reach.
It's a completely different thing. But the problem is, see, the stretch that's at the base of this lie, if you will, is that Microsoft... But consider this, right? What Microsoft is trying to do is cast the Windows Store as the biggest online marketplace that there is.
Yeah.
And this is the store that's only going to be in Windows 8. And the way they're casting it that way is they're saying, hey, look, we have a run rate of this year, it's going to be 350 million Windows 7-based PCs. We have an established base of 1.3 billion computers actively running Windows every single day.
Right.
That is a huge market. That market is bigger than the market for any mobile device, iOS, Android, whatever. Thus, developers really need to think about targeting this market.
Yes.
Which is cute, except that that 1.3 billion, those 350 million people, none of them are running Windows 8. So, right. Well, I mean, right? I mean, this is what I'm saying. So, in other words,
well, yeah,
Microsoft is,
they might.
Well, they might not. I mean, I understand the point they're trying to make, but you see that they're using data for an old version of Windows
right.
to justify
extrapolate
a new version of Windows, right. which they've just said is being reborn into something completely different, which it is.
Right.
So we've talked before about Windows 8 and worst case scenarios and things like that. And I think that at the very least, Windows 8 will be a Vista style release in the sense that it's obviously still going to sell several hundred billion copies a year. It will be as whatever. We'll see how popular it is. I don't know. Certainly people, including myself, have raised issues about the Frankenstein-like nature of this system where they've melded this new
OS.
It's
alive. Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
You know, well, but they have, right? It's a strange thing. We'll see if people accept it or not. But anyway, this 500 million quote was misquoted. Although, like I said, I think the important thing to note is that it's based in something that Microsoft has been saying all along, which is that they're justifying the number of Windows PCs and devices that will be sold, say, between now and the end of 2013, between 400 and 500 million devices.
Right.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Will 10 million of those be running Windows 8 or 20 million? Yeah, it's hard to say. Microsoft typically sells about 20 million copies of Windows in a quarter, 20 to 25, somewhere in there. So assuming this thing comes out in October like we expect, 20, 25, 30, that's in the ballpark. It's not 500 million. So I don't know. You know, I'm just trying to explain it, I guess. I'm not justifying it or, you know.
Well, and all of these numbers are so hefty that, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
That's still a lot. Compare this to anything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Android. I mean, even if you wanted to, like, extend it beyond desktops, it's huge. So.
Yes. Yes. I mean, so I think the loftiest projection I had seen for tablets for this year was somewhere in the 100 million range, 100
right.
million unit
right.
range, right? Two-thirds of those will be iPads.
Right.
You know, 350 million versus 100 million, it's still a big difference. Obviously, smartphones kind of skew those results fairly dramatically, but then smartphones are not PCs, are not tablets. I think you can make a case that the simplicity of tablets will draw people away from computers. Even though tablets aren't really personal computers in a traditional sense, they certainly will take people from that market.
Right.
You're not going to hand anyone an iPod Touch or an iPhone and say, here, do all of your computing on this. I mean, most people just won't do that. The screen's too small.
Do you think we're coming to that day, though, where an iPad becomes the one and only computer that some people
have? Yeah, absolutely. Because the one epiphany that I think we have about the iPad is that, you know, I had said right away that my initial gut reaction to the iPad was, this thing's just a big iPod Touch. I don't get it. But it is, in fact, the fact that it is a big iPod Touch is what makes the difference.
It's the story. I agree with you.
You know, it sounds obvious in
retrospect.
Until
you use it. Well, but yeah, right. You have to use it before you get it, I think.
Well, it's not really about the resolution of it per se, although that improves certain things like reading, especially, I would say, the new version. But it really is the size of the screen makes a difference, and then the utter simplicity of the system itself makes a difference. You know, people fight with computers every day. And they never stop to think, why are we doing this? You know, why am I doing this? I think I gave
what you
this.
Do.
Well, I know, but you know, I was at a dinner party a few months ago, and a friend of ours who's in the financial business or whatever has a years old computer of some kind, and she had been faithfully backing it up and doing all this stuff, and the computer won't start anymore, and she was telling me that I did a system restore, and the sheer level of like technical troubleshooting things that she knew about in Windows should be a warning sign to anybody that any normal human being needs to know about that stuff or think about it.
That's my issue exactly.
You know, I think that's the trouble. And, you know, we've talked about the car truck thing that Steve Jobs brought up. And really, it's kind of the complexity part of it, right?
Yep.
The early vehicles that we had in the early part of the 20th century required you to be a mechanic. You had to really know what you were doing to own a car. But for that thing to become mainstream, of course, it has to be a sealed box. I mean, obviously, we have to bring them in and get them fixed. But, you know, aside from the occasional flat tire, you really shouldn't have to know too much other than turn the key and drive, right?
Right.
And I think the iPad represents a kind of leap in maturity from a simplicity standpoint. And I think that's why it's a big deal that, you know, in the screen, I guess, right?
Well, it is. It's kind of ineffable, and I think that it's kind of, that is the challenge. It is kind of an odd thing. I don't know what the
Is. So the oddness, and I don't know that I ever raised this issue in this way before, but you know, when you look at Windows 98, clearly just the metro bit of it is Microsoft's very unique and fairly innovative take on a simple system. You know,
yeah.
And they've done a good job of thinking it through. They are even making it simple from a reliability and security standpoint that users shouldn't have to really worry about stuff that they worry about now.
Right.
You know, you don't have to worry about downloading a bad program from the internet because you can only download good programs now. You know, they're taking away things that used to be potential trouble spots for users. So that's good. The problem is they've melded it onto the old Windows, right? So these aren't two separate things. They're two separate things in one box. And I think that's going to be confusing for people. And again, we'll see how they react to it. But I also believe, and no one's ever told me this, but I think they're doing it this way because every time they've done it separately, it's kind of failed, right? In other words, their experience with Windows Phone said, maybe we shouldn't make something that's a separate tablet OS because a very small number of people will buy it. But if we put it in the box with Windows, we can kind of jam it down people's throats. And hundreds of millions of people will own this thing, you know, and that's how we can get it out to the mass market. It's a little awful when you say it that way, but I think from a strategic standpoint, it almost makes some sense because their standalone efforts, like the Zune devices, Windows Phone so far, have not reached a mainstream audience, a widespread mainstream audience. And maybe this is the only way they can make that happen.
Right.
You know, they couldn't release Windows 8 without the desktop and say, hey, it's the next version of Windows. Enjoy.
You're saying it's a transitional operating system, and operating system on the way. So that's the quote, which is it's the beginning. What do they say? The beginning of the new Windows.
Yep,
that's what
There's never been a change like this in the history of Windows ever, not once. You know, when they switched very slowly over many years from the 9X code base to the NT code base,
right.
What we were left with at the other end was Windows.
Right.
The time at which that worked was when the application compatibility was identical between the two systems,
right.
The driver model was identical between the two systems, and consumers were able to make a seamless shift between them, right?
Right?
So from a usage standpoint, there was no difference. You know, it was more secure, it was more reliable, but it was the same Windows. You know, even the move to the NT code base was nothing like this.
Right. No, this is something... Well, that's clear, and it's a big bet. I mean, they're making a big bet.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Bravo.
I guess. I mean, you know, again, we can quibble about the details, and I do. Certainly, I've made a living out of it, actually. But
he's the king of quibbles.
Yeah.
Quibbles.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, and somebody wrote me an email that actually contradicted this, but until, like, literally yesterday, I've presented Windows 8 to user groups in the area. I've presented it at trade conferences and, several times now. I've talked to IT pros and administrators, you know, typical office knowledge workers, et cetera. I've never met anyone, although someone emailed me yesterday to contradict this, that felt good about Windows 8. Not even once. But
do you think that will change? I mean, do you think that that's...
I don't think it matters.
Well, okay, I'll give you an analogy. You said once you held the iPad, you realized it was so much more than just an iPod Touch on steroids. Do you think once everybody starts using Windows 8, they'll go, oh, wow, I don't think so.
They won't in business.
No, business is going to really rebel.
Yeah, and the problem is manifold, but I would say the two big issues are that it's too different, it's too much new, right, which they have a problem with. Even some of the things that Microsoft said earlier on they were going to keep the same, they're now going to change. So businesses are really going to rebel against this. But the other big one is, as slow as these companies do move, they are in fact rolling out Windows 7 finally in bigger than ever numbers. And they're not going to roll out Windows 8 again. They're not going to do it again. They might not even do Windows 9.
That's it. You know, they're done.
They're done for a while. This is how they do things. Windows 7 is the next XP in business. It's going to be around forever. Now, that's fine.
Wait a minute. Windows 7 is the next XP. In other words, the one that nobody wants to trade up from until right. they absolutely have no choice.
The interesting thing about this is I don't think it's going to impact Windows sales in the slightest, because the way the volume licensing contracts at Microsoft work is that you have the downgrade rights to go to any version you want that's still supported. So Windows 7 will remain as the, you know, in other words, people will, or companies rather, will buy new Windows 8 PCs next year, and many of them will downgrade to Windows 7 on those devices because they can. And because they want that consistency, they don't want to have to train their users. They're not ready for that new stuff yet. I think from Microsoft, this is a calculated risk that they, I don't want to say they don't care, but they don't care because they need to attract consumers right now. They're already behind on that stuff. People are increasingly turning to non-traditional computers like the iPad and to Apple or even Google solutions, whatever those things might be. This is where they need to make a stand. And, you know, like I've said this in the past, I really do believe that people are going to walk into a Best Buy, which now has a huge tablet section instead of a huge PC section.
Oh, that's interesting. Is it as big as the PC section, or is it?
Yeah, it's what the PC section used to be.
Oh, how interesting. It's very strange.
You got to go to Best Buy. Yeah. You know, computers, the things that actually sell, are kind of pushed off to the side. I made the comparison to what Apple did in the 1980s, where the Apple II was making all the money, but they were pushing the Mac in the early days before desktop publishing came around and saved it. And, you know, they had the whole Apple II thing, you know, forever thing. And,
Apple II forever, in the same way. 6 months, whichever comes first.
Yeah. In the same way, you know, the PC market right now is not, obviously not growing fast, 2-5%, whatever it is, you know, over the past couple of years. But tablets are growing fast, but don't have the volume yet. So I think we're in this transitional phase. But 6 months from now, 9 months from now, whatever, you're going to walk into a Best Buy and you'll see everything from little black and white Kindles to Android tablets and iPads, obviously. And then you're going to see these Windows 8 tablets. And I really think that looking at those and then hearing that those things are completely compatible, at least in the Intel variant versions, I think a lot of, and just seeing what they look like, I mean, they're beautiful and colorful and dynamic. You know, the displays on these things are fantastic. I think they're going to sway a lot of consumers. And I think that's the point, you know, that of Windows 8, that is, you know, that they need to do this now and they can afford to ignore the business end, because, listen, they could have gone nuts on the business stuff in this version. Businesses were still never going to upgrade. They just did Windows 7. Why waste the time? You know, their decision in that way makes a lot of sense.
Right. We're starting to see some more features in the preview.
Yeah.
I haven't updated the – is there an update to the preview? Is that what we want to do?
No. So Microsoft released the consumer preview version of Windows 8 back the last day of February, February 29th.
At CTIA.
And they're going to release the release preview version in the first week of June.
Oh, okay. So there's a new version coming next week or in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. A little bit more, somewhere in there. I've actually been told June 1st is the day by one source. So we'll see if that pans out. There was what I took to be a hint in a screenshot that Microsoft provided, where the date in the calendar tile was June 8th. No, but there was also more, because there were 8 emails in the email app.
Oh.
And the temperature, which was for a place in...
8 degrees.
It was 68 degrees. 6-8.
Oh, 6-8.
Yeah.
June 8th.
That's pretty
good. That's better than Paul is Dead. You're really good
at
this.
My version of being Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. We'll see what happens. But
so
I was
June
told
8th.
Later.
That makes a lot of sense.
I was told June 1st, but I saw June 8th in the screenshot.
Wow, so, that's really interesting.
Well, obviously,
soon either way, and it doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a lot different?
Yes, it is.
Oh, and, boy.
Okay. So mostly it's basically mapping to what I said previously, which was that the underlying OS, you know, the platform bits aren't changing a lot. I mean, they're tweaking the start screen and tiles, and there are more color schemes and all that stuff. I mean, that's all very minor.
That's cosmetic. Okay.
The big changes are coming in the apps. And that was, you know, what I had said before was that, you know, these things that are app previews, some of which are actually still called app previews for some reason in the release preview, are changing very dramatically. Very dramatically. And there was a lot of stuff that was very broken or inconsistent. There were some really strange things in the consumer preview, and that's all been cleaned up and made whole. So I think that's this one's going to be a big deal. It's not quite feature complete. There's, oddly enough, we're still going to change some things after the release preview, including the theme that they use for the classic Explorer interface, which where they're getting rid of the glass, the Aero glass effects, and they're replacing it with a, it's kind of a white, opaque UI that if you're familiar with Microsoft's other products, things like Office 15, which is coming down the pike, or the revised version of Visual Studio 11, or the Zune PC software, you know, you get this kind of interface that's Metro-like. It's not actually a Metro interface, but it's got this kind of opaque flatness to it. They're going to switch the theme from Aero to that, whatever that's called, modern or something. So we shall see. But we're not going to see that in the release preview. But what's been happening is, you know, of course, Raphael and I have been writing a book. And we spent about 2 months killing ourselves to get first pass of it done.
Paul, when were you going to learn? They do this every time to you. Don't tell me. The screenshots are all different.
Well, no, of course. So we knew that from day one. So. Right. But the thing we also knew was that there would be heavy revisions. Everything that we wrote has to be revised because everything is changing.
You still have to do what you can.
Right. So combined with the screenshots that we took, Wiley has told me that the book we've come up with so far is roughly 650 pages long, which is exactly where we want it to be. The problem is
none of it's right.
Well, a lot, it has to be revised, but we also have to add a bunch of stuff. So that means we're going to have to take stuff out. So I had already taken out a bunch of stuff about like the classic version of Explorer because that stuff dated back to IE9. And, you know, we're going to have to be judicious about what we did. We cut a couple of chapters that were sort of peripheral to the main story.
You kind of know this, though, going in. This is normal, right? I mean,
absolutely. No, we knew we had to because of schedule reasons right off.
Do what you can. Hope that nothing changes, and then change it when you have to.
But the thing that's interesting for us is a couple of weeks back, we finally started getting looks at more recent builds of the product. And so we're very well prepared now for the release preview, which is something, you know, maybe 3 weeks ago, whatever.
Right.
I'm not sure I would have been able to say that. So we're now revising it and preparing stuff for the web, of course. But what's happening is as this stuff comes out, of course, other sites, Chinese websites and, you know, tech enthusiast websites are starting to leak information. And our goal with acquiring recent builds of the product was never to write those first posts, you know, like, oh, look, they have this new thing. You know, it was really for the book. And the problem is now that this stuff is leaking, we're trying to address that because, of course, people will see something on an enthusiast website of some kind and say, hey, how come you're not writing about this?
Nobody's seeing your book. Oh, you mean on the blog? I mean, nobody sees the book yet.
No, right. But other people have acquired these leaks as well.
Right.
And so they're starting to write about them. And so some of the things I can talk about because we've written about them include some actually fairly blockbuster little bits of information. So, for example, Microsoft 2 years ago announced that they were making a big bet on web standards with IE9 at the time and also with IE10, and that they were working toward a model where IE would not have any more plugins, you know, that you wouldn't need add-ons, that all of these bits of new functionality would be supplied through HTML5. And in Windows 8, of course, IE10 doesn't even allow plugins. So if you want to do things like Silverlight or Flash, those things are not available. But what they were working on secretly that I can now discuss is that they worked with Adobe to get the source code to Flash, and they're building it into IE so that it can run Flash natively, even in the Metro version. But because they want to protect consumers from Flash-based websites that might try to do them harm, they're using a whitelist through the compatibility view list that already exists in IE to only allow you to use Flash on those sites that are known to be trusted, you know, NBC, YouTube, you know, whatever, that kind of thing.
That's not a bad way to do it. To the trusted list? Or
Not that
they
I am.
They maintain that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's fine. I mean, you know, if I'm doing Flash on my site and I'm too small for them to notice, that means it won't work. But
well, you know, their contention, which I think is fair enough, is that, you know, Flash is the past and HTML5 is the future. The problem is, you know, a consumer is going to buy a Windows RT tablet and they're going to want to go to nickjr.com or disney.com.
Right. So we'll allow those.
Well, when they're known to be,
Even on the tablet. It'll even on ARM, they'll have Flash.
Yep.
Yeah, that's good.
So that's a big one.
It's a way of doing what Apple did in a more friendly way to the user.
Yes, other than writing a manifesto describing
other than saying
flashes,
it ain't
going to
work no matter what to get over.
Well, I mean, Microsoft had come out 2 years ago and basically said the same thing. I mean, they were a little kinder about
it. Oh, it's true. And if you think of all the
buggy.
Well,
that's the thing. So, you know, the Metro environment is designed to be many things, but it's supposed to be trustworthy and reliable and secure and all this stuff. So I think the way they've added Flash into IE is very interesting because it doesn't really subvert any of that stuff. You know, it's still a trusted environment that will be fine going forward. Someone, by the way, had asked me via email if you could turn it off, and yes, you can. So if you don't want Flash, actually, it's
turn
just
it off. Yeah,
it's just an add-in.
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, if you're just using Flash to play back video, it's dumb because the video within the Flash wrapper is completely HTML5. It's H.264. Right. In most cases, you could play it back. Flash is just a control, system.
I don't think it's mostly. Excuse me. For video, I think it's more for the sites that have interactive content.
That's exactly. If it's video, it's a trivial thing to fix. You know,
video's not a problem. I think it's kids go to play games.
Right.
That's the different. iPad, for all of its wonderfulness, you know, kids will browse to those familiar websites
they have. Yeah,
and sometimes they can't play the games because they're written in Flash. So.
Right. No, that's legit. I think that's actually legit.
Yeah. So I think that's good. That's a neat one. There are going to be some new apps in the release preview. There's a news app, a travel app, and a what was the other one? Sports app. And they're sort of. It's funny. You could describe them as RSS front ends, which makes them sound pretty lame, but they're actually beautiful to look at and have amazing sources on the back end. Really high end. You know, like Frommer's is one of the sources in the travel app. You know, in the news app, it's all of the main, you know, the huge news organizations. Very nice. Beautiful presentation, multimedia, big pictures, beautiful looking. So that stuff's kind of cool. The other one that I was very eager to look at, and we had written about this for the book, was the add features to Windows 8 functionality. And this is the thing that replaces Windows Anytime Upgrade, right? And you may recall that Microsoft announced that they were ripping Media Center out of Windows, but they were going to let you upgrade to it and to Windows 8 Pro using an add-on pack. And this functionality will exist in some way in the release preview. So you can see what it's going to look like at least. And you know, it's fairly seamless and everything. I sometimes feel that in Microsoft's mad rush to reimagine everything in Windows, they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like they're just reinventing everything. You know, so to me, it's like, well, Windows Anytime Upgrade already worked fine. Why are you changing the way it looks, where it's found, but you know. How it works and so forth, but they are, so whatever. But you can type in your credit card information. You can PayPal.
I did like that.
Yeah. So you can do this electronically. And, of course, it's Windows 8, so this stuff happens.
Now, in Windows 7, it was all on the disk, right? I don't think you downloaded a whole bunch. They could do it the same way or...
Yeah, actually, the way it is now, you are doing some downloading. So I haven't looked into that to see whether Media Center is hiding on your disk. I'm guessing that it's not. Because otherwise people would probably figure out how to break into it. But these are smaller updates, and maybe that's part of the arc. You know, the difference. You know, Windows Anytime Upgrade, you were basically buying a key, and it would unlock files that Windows had installed on your disk. And in Windows 8, it appears that what's actually happening is you're downloading things from the internet, but they're not huge. The delta between Windows 8 Core and it's really called Windows 8 Core, but whatever, and Windows 8 Pro. Is not great, right? So it's not a lot to download. And I think today you can make an assumption that most people who are doing this are going to have decent broadband and so forth. So it's not as bad maybe as it would have been 3-6 years ago, whatever.
But I do like that feature. And I think it's good for Microsoft because it makes it easier to pay money to Microsoft. And
yeah, exactly.
Nothing wrong with that.
We'll see how much that stuff costs. We still don't know, but... we'll see.
You know, this is kind of a little off topic, but for a long time, didn't Microsoft want to kind of get everybody into the subscription mode where you'd pay?
Oh, yeah. No, they're still peddling this. You know, they don't have a Windows subscription model yet outside of the enterprise, of course. But they did this with Office for many years, but they tried to do that. They're doing it right now with the Xbox 360. They're experimenting with that plan where you can buy a 4-gigabyte Xbox 360 plus Kinect. For $100, and then you pay $15 a month for Xbox Live Gold for 2 years. They want that badly because, you know, for a company like Microsoft, big company like Microsoft, getting a big bump every 3 years is neat, but what they really want is steady income over time. You know, they don't want down quarters. They want it to be fairly steady. I don't, that doesn't always mesh with how people want to buy things, but, and I think there's also that kind of a weird psychology behind software, you know, where people, just like music and things like that, you know, they want to own something, you know, they don't want to feel like they're renting it, that it could be taken away from them, right, at any time.
One thing I know people are upset about is the loss of Aero Glass. I was kind of surprised to see that.
You know, I'm gonna talk to these guys soon, and I have to ask. I have to remember.
Why would they do that?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is they hate users. No.
if you like it, we don't.
Oh, did you like that? Yeah, we're taking that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's complicated because when you promote something like crazy for 5 years, and then you take it out, it's like a little.
So let's actually. I can explain why they're taking it out, but let's step back a minute. And you may remember this because when we first started doing this podcast, Windows Vista was just going to come out, and one of the conversations I'm sure we had very early on, like 6 years ago, early on, was this notion that Apple had added transparency and translucency effects to OS X. Right, in 2001, I guess, right? That was when they did it. And remember that first version of OS X, they had kind of like a ribbed they had kind of lines in the UI. It was white and it had like gray lines in it. And so the menu would come up over that and then you could still see those lines through the menu. And you could see over subsequent versions of OS X that Apple became more mature about how they handled translucencies, that they got better at it. You know, in the beginning, it was all about the effect. You know, they had that genie effect where, you know, things would shrink down to the dock and come back out. And remember, he would do it over and over again in the demos. They would slow it down so you could really see it. It was all about those effects. But then you sort of realize over time that, you know, some of these things are gratuitous and they're almost childish. You know, they're not mature and they don't really help usability in any meaningful way. And so you get rid of the ones that don't and you keep the ones that do, but you tone it down. And so Microsoft, in typical Microsoft fashion, comes around 6 years after the fact and says, hey, now we're going to have translucency too. And, you know, right off the bat, the first thing they did was they did it wrong. I mean, it was too translucent. It was, you know, it would be like a muddy effect where the thing behind the glass of the current window, you could sort of see it, but it was all muddy looking. Actually, it's still like that in Windows 7 now that I'm looking at it. But they cleaned that up a little bit in Windows 7. And actually, they cleaned it up again in Windows 8, although, you know, now they're going to get rid of it. The version of Aero that's in Windows 8 today in the consumer preview and in the release preview is very toned down from the version that debuted in Windows Vista, not just from an effect standpoint, but from a hardware requirement standpoint. Because one of the things that they found out was that these glass effects, they impact battery life pretty dramatically.
Oh, battery life. I didn't even think of that.
That's the real reason they're getting rid of it. That when you think about all of these goals they have to make Metro reliable and a known quantity to the user, that one of the things they couldn't take any control over was, what if the user just put it on the desktop and they had Windows open and those windows had lots of glass? Right. We were always displaying this stuff under stuff. You know, that impacts the battery. What they want
that
is...
Now that makes sense. I wish they'd say that.
Well, they've beaten around the bush about it. I mean, they've kind of... But that's the real reason. It's,
yeah,
it's
that
about
makes
battery.
Sense. And... You know, I mean, it's like ActiveX desktop. How long? I mean, yeah. There's some things people might use, but sometimes
so
the world
remember,
moves on.
Office 15 is going to come out, and these things will support a full screen mode. They're actually just desktop apps. They don't use the glass. They use their own UI. In fact, it's a very much like...
Well, yeah, and when you're full screen, what do you need glass for? There's nothing behind there.
Yeah, but it's funny because Microsoft's going to emulate that effect in Explorer now. And so I think the point behind Office 15 was that you could use these applications in full screen mode on a Windows 8 or Windows RT tablet. You could flip between applications. So you Metro app, Metro app, Metro app, and then Office 15. And the user wouldn't notice the difference because these things all ran full screen. They were opaque, et cetera. That was fine. But the problem is, it's cute if someone upgrades to Office 15, but for all those people who are using Office 2010 or Office 2007 or the many, many, many other desktop apps, sometimes floating in Windows, sometimes full screen, there's still a lot of glass going on. And one way you can fix that, of course, is to get rid of the glass. So I hope, and this is the second question I need to ask them about this change, is whether they're going to make Arrow available as an option. I think they should. And I hope that it's in there. You know, in other words, it won't be the default, but maybe it will still be in there in the personalized control panel, and people can turn it on if that's what they want. And I hope they do that. I think that would be a nice touch. It's the code's already there. You know, someone like me who runs a desktop computer doesn't care about the battery life implications of something that's never going to impact them. And I happen to like this look. So, you know, maybe I want to run Glass and not whatever this new
right.
modern UI is. So we'll see. I hope they do that.
I am now sympathetic given the battery life issue.
Yeah.
I understand that. We're going to take a break.
I understand it. Well, but actually, before we take a break, though.
Yes.
But I just wanted to kind of finish the thought on this.
Yeah.
So we understand, and I agree with you. I think it's fine that that's what they're doing. But here's the thing. Microsoft, the way they announced this is beautiful, classic Microsoft these days, was courtesy of an 11,000-word blog post.
Right.
Called Creating the Windows 8 User Experience, which right. included about 7,000 words on the history of Windows and all the different user experiences they've had, and blah, right. on and on. Yeah. You know, it's the type of thing that's designed to put you to sleep so you're not paying attention by the end of it. 10,363 words into this blog post, Leo. There was a sentence.
Then.
Where they said, oh, and by the way, we're getting rid of Arrow. Like, seriously. And you know, I just, for me, this was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will. You know, that I just get this feeling, I feel like these guys are making it up. You know, I want to believe that there's a plan, that 3 years ago, some smart group of people sat down at a table and said, this is what Windows 8 is going to be. But I think increasingly I'm beginning to realize that that's not what happened, you know, that they're sort of making it up as they go along. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, you know. I guess I've said this before, too. I guess I don't mind it. But the thing I'm concerned about, really, I think the big picture problem is, they're going to release this thing, you know, and people are going to react to it one way or the other. Some people are going to love it. Some people, a lot of people, unfortunately, are probably going to hate it. Some people are going to wonder what all the fuss is, you know, whatever. But everyone's going to have all their different reactions. But the truth is, this Metro thing is 1.0. It's just 1.0.
Right.
It needs to be updated again and again and again. And they've created a system where the apps that run under Metro can be updated again and again and again. In fact, it's kind of ironic that Microsoft was forced by antitrust regulators to pull a bunch of applications out of Windows, and that they made lemonade out of that by saying, well, okay, but now we'll put these things in Windows Live Essentials, and now we can upgrade them all the time. And then they never upgraded them all the time. But now they're going to bring them back into Windows, but because they'll be updated through the Windows Store, even though Windows 8 may sit there statically and not change for 3 years, which, by the way, I think would be a mistake, but those apps can all be upgraded over time and will be. So I guess they've solved that problem. But I think the Metro environment itself, this kind of 1.0, you know, the Frankenstein's monster thing I was talking about, they really need to fix that. And they need to fix that before 3 years from the time Windows 8 ships. So I hope what we see, and I've heard nothing about this, but I hope that what we see is some indication that that's going to happen, that we're not going to be stuck with this thing for 3 years in its, you know, in its current form. I think that would be a big mistake. Windows is too important, I think, for this new thing, this rebirth of Windows, as they call it, to sit still for that long.
Do you think that they telegraphed it a little bit with the, the new logo, right? They strip out all the 3D effects, all the color, all the cruft, and it's just square. And it almost is saying, hey, yeah. Metro is going to be simple. And Arrow is, UI...
simple. It's like simple, like it's like simple, like Forrest Gump is simple. It's no, it's like it's
Windows 8 is like a box of chocolates. You never know what
you click on a tile, and you never know what you're gonna get. No, I, you know, people have sort of sarcastically said, you know, it's not Windows 8 anymore. It's Window 8 because there's only
Window 8. Good, I like it. Let's reimagine.
I don't know. Yeah. No, they've done some work to make the side by side stuff possible. So you can't do that on an iPad or another tablet.
Oh, really? So I'll be able to have two side by side windows on my tablet.
Not in a beautiful configurable way, but yes, in a very limited fashion, you can have two things side by side. Not two full apps, but you know, apps have to have what's called a snapped experience. It's a 23-25 pixel wide, you know, version of that app,
right,
whatever.
Right.
You can run something on the side. You can run, you know, your desktop or another app on the screen. That's okay. I think there's going to be some work in the future to make the multi-monitor stuff better. And I mean better in a Metro sense, because right now all of the Metro stuff has to occur basically on one screen. And I mean the Metro apps, not the Metro side effects. Those they are fixing in this release. So I think they'll improve it. But again, you know, my fear is they'll wait 3 years to improve it. I really think that this is the APIs need to improve every year like they do for Windows Phone. You know, that they went from Windows Phone 7 to Windows Phone 7.5 in 1 year, and then to Windows Phone 8 1 year after that. They need to do that for Windows 8. They really do. The underpinnings of this system are too immature for this to sit still for this long.
Yeah. So in 3 years or less, Windows 9.
Hopefully less.
It'll be 8.1.
I'd like to see an 8.1, 8.2. Yeah, 8.3, that's what I'd like to see.
8.4. Yep. We're going to take a break. Then I want to want you to answer the actually a very important question, which is, and we talked about this 2 weeks ago, and you went to the developer camp, right?
Ooh.
So I want to talk about developers. By the way, thank you, Iaz, for filling in for me last week. And I've hardly been here, but I know you've been to developers camp since I was here last. So let's talk about that. But before we do, I'd like to talk about Carbonite, the best way to back yourself up. Carbonite.com. What should a good backup have? Think about it. Should be automatic, right? You shouldn't have to remember to back up. Yeah, okay. So let's say you've got scheduler running and every Sunday you back up, right? Well, yeah, but what about Monday through Saturday? If you make changes, are you going to lose those if you have a crash before Sunday? What about automatic continuous backup? Okay, so there's two things all the time. The third thing is very important. It might not be obvious, but if you're backing up, and I know all of you are, to a hard drive right next to your computer or a USB key or a DVD or something, And everything's in the same spot, now you're at risk, because if you have a fire or a flood or a tornado, I mean, a real disaster, the backups are gone too. And believe me, it happens. The best backup is automatic, continuous, and off-site. And that's why I recommend and tell everybody to use Carbonite.com. Carbonite is all three. It's off-site backup, uses 128-bit SSL, so anytime you're online, even at an open Wi-Fi access point, you're backing up securely, safely. You can add your own encryption. You keep the key. This is Steve Gibson's Trust No One model. And it means that you have absolute privacy. They cannot see your data at Carbonite. That's good if privacy is important to you. And the price is right. It starts at $59 a year. That's less than $5 per computer per month. And that means they don't put a limit on it. More than 200 gigabytes, they slow you down a little bit. So I would say think of it as kind of 200 gigabytes plus if you have other stuff you need to back up. But 200 gigabytes for most people, you're not backing up the OS. You're not backing up the apps. You're not backing up your music or movies in most cases because you've got copies of those. It's really about backing up your personal data that you cannot reproduce, that you do not have a copy of anywhere else. And here's the beauty part. You can get to that data anytime online. It's cloud storage, too. They have smartphone apps. They have tablet apps. Of course, you can log on to your Carbonite account on any PC or Mac, by the way. It's Mac or PC. So I want you to give it a try. If you visit Carbonite.com, CarboniteCom, right now, you could take a look, see the different plans they have. The basic plan, $59 a year, but they have also plans for multiple drives, small businesses, and so forth. Any of these you could try for free. You don't need a credit card. You just need our offer code, Windows. And then if you decide to buy, ooh, that gets cooler. You get 2 months free, 14 months for the price of 12, as long as you use the offer code Windows. You got to back it up to get it back. So do it right with Carbonite. Again, the offer code is Windows. So tell me about Developer Day. Was that fun? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was great. Chris Bowen, I think, was the guy who did it. The guy's amazing. You know Aaron Hilgus, obviously.
Yeah, and, Big Nerd Ranch, yeah.
Yeah, this guy, it was amazing how similar he was to Aaron.
Oh, interesting.
Both in his demeanor and look and style and all that. I mean, he wasn't quite as 7 foot tallish as Aaron was, but but who is? So, you know, that was good. And it was actually particularly good for me because I've often said, you know, when I went to Big Nerd Ranch last year and did the iOS class, and you know, we need something that good on the Windows side.
Yeah, and it really is a good way to bring in developers. I agree. And Microsoft should do it.
Yeah, and well, this Microsoft did do this. So this is like a traveling roadshow they're doing, and yeah, it was great. It was high level. There wasn't a lot of actual coding, but it was more of an introduction to the environment and the capabilities of the environment. And also, I wanted to say, you know, a couple of weeks back, I made the plea on this podcast for people who have written, you know, Silverlight or Windows Phone apps and are looking at Windows 8 to email me, and many did, and I have not gotten back to any of those people yet, and I wanted to apologize for that. I will do that. I've been collecting the emails. I want to use them toward a sort of a Windows 8 for developers overview type article that I'll be writing, which also this experience will go into. So if you did write me about that, thank you. And I will get back to you. I need to, I'm just behind on doing that. So I apologize for that. But a bunch of people did write me in, or write into me. Their feedback was very interesting. Some of it was amazing. I mean, some people had some very detailed information about it. I think the high level view goes something like this. You know, if you are experienced with any of the .NET technologies, whether it's the .NET framework itself or WPF or Silverlight or Windows Phone, which is a Silverlight based environment, and you're making the transition from that to Windows 8, you will recognize the style of the APIs and all that. I mean, a lot of the actual names of classes and methods and so on have changed, so you need to do that little bit of work. This is part of my argument earlier about this thing being a 1.0 experience. It is, and I think for developers, you know, developers who target Windows 8 are going to discover that there are things that just aren't there yet, you know. I'm seeing Microsoft start to kind of scale back from this argument that you can somehow program native code that is C++, C Sharp, Visual Basic, or JavaScript, and now they're calling it something. It's sort of like near native code. It's like a they call it projected APIs. I think ultimately, anytime you write in a high level language, you're writing to a framework or an API of some kind, and that there's always something lower level underneath it. I think that's really no different here. But they're promoting this as the native, in air quotes, environment for developers for Windows 8. So in that sense, it's analogous to, say, Win32 back in the Win 3.1 was Win 16, but whatever, Win 3.1, Windows 95, whatever days, because it is the mainstream way, you know, the main way that developers will target Windows 8. You know, there's some confusing bits. I mean, there's people who have done anything from Vista on through the .NET stuff or XAML, Silverlight, et cetera, know that there's a nice visual designer that's in Visual Studio. And that continues in Windows 8. So you can have an emulated, you can run it right on the machine, of course, but you can also run it in an emulator and target different screen resolutions and pixel densities and so forth. And that's nice. But if you're going to run if you're going to use HTML instead of XAML, and you're going to use JavaScript instead of one of the other higher level languages and so forth, that visual designer is not available in Visual Studio. You have to go through Blend. And I think that's a little, that's interesting. I'm wondering if someday they're going to tie those things into a more cohesive single environment that works across all of the different technology types and so forth. But I would say, you know, overall, there are good capabilities. And the Windows 8 stuff, you know, the Metro stuff is very close to what you would expect, you know, of a mobile OS. I mean, it works very much at a high level. Again, not from the specifics, but it's the same stuff that you would expect to see in Windows Phone or in iOS or Android probably, although I haven't looked that much at that, where, you know, you have the capability to tie into system services. Some of that stuff I think is more consistent in Windows 8 than it is in other environments. So there are things like Search, which is just built in that you get to attach yourself to, which is pretty exciting, so that someone could run a system search and then retarget the search toward your app. So that if you search for, you know, Paul Thurrott, you could come up and look at for applications that are called Paul Thurrott. You could look for files that are named Paul Thurrott to have Paul Thurrott in the file. You could look for Paul Thurrott within Mail, and it would search your mail. Look for Paul Thurrott on the web, and it would, you know, search Bing using Internet Explorer and so forth. That stuff is very exciting. So I think they've really kind of ratcheted up the capabilities so that when you compare Windows 8 to other mobile platforms, in many ways it's actually more sophisticated. Simply by virtue of the fact that it came last, right? It's, you know, it has come after this stuff. So they've been able to look at what's out there and kind of take the best ideas and use some new stuff of their own. So I'm going to write about it. I guess the way to say it is just that I haven't really written a lot of code, so I can't speak too much to that yet. I've played around with it. I've played around with the different languages and the emulator and running, you know, the code natively and all that kind of stuff. And it's changing. I mean, there's going to be a new version of the API set, you know, the SDK that's coming for the release preview. There's going to be some documentation from Microsoft that will describe those changes. So if you've actually been working with this stuff already, you're going to notice that a bunch of stuff is changing. It's not going to be awful like it was in the long run days, but it is definitely changing. So I guess I'll just leave it at, I've got a lot to write about. I feel better about it, let's say, than I did maybe a couple weeks ago.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Did you hear from people? I know there were people who wanted to contact you. Quite a few. Was that useful?
Some of it was amazing. I mean, it was all useful. I mean, none of it was silly or anything, but I mean, some of it was just really well written and very well argued. You know, you could tell these people care a lot about this stuff and know a lot about it. And
That's neat.
It was good.
Well, and in fact, that bodes well. You want developers who are passionate about the platform.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing Microsoft's been good at. I think a lot of people cut their teeth on Microsoft products. So
I think you were out for this. I don't know if it was last week, but, you know, Charles Petzold.
Yeah.
Is writing a book about Windows 8 programming.
Oh, great.
And it's available now.
He writes great stuff. I love his stuff.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's the godfather of this stuff, obviously. Mm-hmm. His new book, which is Programming Windows 6th Edition, I think is the title, involves Metro-style programming C#, you know, for Windows 8. He's releasing it over time so that if you buy the electronic version now, it constantly, you can get it for
$10. Oh, that's great.
And what you get at the first several, I think it's 7 or 8 chapters, it's targeted at the release, I'm sorry, at the consumer preview. He'll update it in, say, July for the release preview, add more chapters, and then he'll update it again for the final version. And if you buy in now, of course, you get all those other updates for free. So eventually this thing will cost as much as any other computer programming book, $60. But if you buy it, I think there's another week remaining, you can get it for as low as $10, which is just an amazing deal. I mean, Charles Petzold is.
I should order it. That's great.
Yeah.
And
that's fantastic.
Just support Charles. He's great. He's great.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah. That's neat. And I think it's a good way to do it because it's a changing landscape, right? And so you want to you want to have an ongoing.
He is the trusted voice.
One of these days we'll get you to doing stuff online.
To do.
You know,
We were joking about this earlier. I'm never going to write a book like this again.
Yeah, you say that every time.
No, well, also, what I've said in the past was I'm never going to write another book.
Right.
I think I'm going to write things that you might describe as a book.
Right.
But I'm not going to do it this way.
This is
the wrong way to do it.
The future is online, collaborative, perhaps.
Exactly.
That's selling it direct.
I want people to be able to read it and provide feedback to it.
Yep.
Contribute to it even.
Yep.
Have it evolve over time. And then when people want to buy it, either in printed, you know, you do self-printing through Amazon now, I believe, or, you know, they want a PDF version of it or a Kindle version, they can do that. I mean, I want it to be something that's more organic and more interactive.
Exactly.
I found that those times when I do interact with people and things like this are hugely positive, you know. And of course I wrote this in the introduction to this new book, and I told you the story at the time, of course, but I will never forget when I went to The Hague, to go to the Windows 7 launch and I spoke there and, we signed some books afterwards, and this Danish man, or rather a Netherlander, came up to me and he said, you know, if Windows 7 is so easy to use, how come your book is over 1,000 pages long? You know, and I thought, I really need to change the way I do things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could still be 1,000 pages, but online, no one knows.
This book that I'm writing now could easily be 1,000 pages. And we're really trying not to make it 1,000 pages.
Right.
It would be 1,000 pages of new stuff. It wouldn't be, previous information. But I desperately want this not to be a book that could kill you if you fell asleep when you were reading it. You know? So we're trying.
And if it's electronic, then it's up to the device not to kill you.
That's right. I can't. If you're going to read this thing on a desktop computer,
that's your problem. Don't read in bed.
Yeah.
What is? Are we still holding firm on an October release date? Seems like they're a little bit ahead of schedule for Windows 8.
I think it's going to work out exactly that way. I do think that they'll. You know, they'll finalize it in very late August, early September. Mainstream release will be in October. I don't see them rushing this. They're very methodical about the way they do things. And I mean, other than the adding features at the last minute thing, but I just don't.
Or subtracting them. Yes.
Yeah. I don't see that happening. I mean, that would be neat. Not for me, but for the rest of the world, that would be neat. But I just don't see that happening.
Well, the reason I ask is because I think Mountain Lion, we don't have a date, of course, and we'll probably know in a couple of weeks for because the Worldwide Developers Conference for Apple is coming up, and I'm sure they'll say at that point. But
Apple will almost certainly release that first.
It's going to be Microsoft. And that's actually an advantage because Microsoft, if they see something, you know, I mean, it's always good to come out a little bit later, and then you can, you know, you can say, hey, we could add that feature.
I think we can look at them now and say, okay, you know, where are these things at? I had written an article.
That's true. I mean,
a long time ago, probably about Lion. I think it was called, you know, what Microsoft could learn from Lion, that kind of thing.
And right.
Some of the interesting ideas that Apple put into their OS their desktop OS product that they had taken from the mobile products, right? Kind of a virtuous cycle that they described where, you know, obviously they built iOS based on Mac OS X, but then there were all these new ideas related to touch and the kind of unique interactions you have on these types of mobile devices. And wouldn't some of them make sense too on the on their desktop product?
Right, you know? Right.
I think that the single most successful thing that Apple did in Lion was the gestures that they put into the trackpad.
Interesting. And I use them. You know, you're right. Yeah. I would have, if you'd asked me up front, I would have said, oh, I'll never use those.
It's not the type of thing you probably would have said right when it launched because they're not discoverable. You have to learn them, right? You have to know they exist, and you have to learn them.
Right.
But if you use those things in combination with the, at the time, a little bit limited full screen capabilities they had, they've actually improved that in Mountain Lion. You get to the system where you can swipe very efficiently between different applications. And one of the things I had written in a more recent article that is the basis of this little discussion is this notion that this seems to be one area where Microsoft and Apple have gone in two different directions, where Microsoft is really about direct interaction with things that are on screen. In other words, you're touching the screen.
Right.
And Apple, in their desktop OS, is about indirect interaction because you're using a trackpad. And the one thing I can tell you is that that's going to change. Windows 8 will support trackpad gestures just like OS 10 does. I don't know if they're going to announce that for the release preview or what their plan is, but that is coming. That's going to be part of Windows 8. And I think that it's funny because that erases what I would say is one of two major conceptual differences between Windows 8 and OS 10 Mountain Lion. Okay. The direct versus indirect interaction with on-screen elements. Okay. So Windows 8 will have both. And I think that's actually going to be an advantage. Because it gives you different device types that you can play with, right? They can have it on a tablet and you can touch the screen. And I don't know of any plans for Apple to do anything like that for OS X. I think the big conceptual difference, and the one that we're never going to bridge, the one that's always going to be different between these two, is that Apple is treating OS X as something different from iOS. It is targeting a different kind of machine. It's a truck. It's not a car, to use the Steve Jobs thing. They'll bring in ideas from the car world, if you will, that make sense for a truck, right? Like an automatic transmission or whatever. But they're not the same code ported over, it seems. It seems like they're kind of re-implementing it, you know. So they have a notification center in Mountain Lion, which I think is very effective, which is based on the notification center.
Yeah, that's exciting, actually. I think that's going to be cool.
Yeah, and it works not the same way that it does in iOS because, of course, the screen you use with the Macintosh computer is completely different.
So
they take advantage of the horizontal resolution that you have and the size of it and so forth, and they implement it as kind of a pane that comes in from the side, and I think that's very effective. That's nice. Now, of course, on the Microsoft side, they've decided that everything needs to be one thing. It's Windows. You know, that we're not going to have Windows Tablet, Windows OS. We're going to have Windows.
Right.
And so I don't see that bridge ever being crossed, you know, between the two products. So I think there is the one big conceptual difference between these things. And we'll see. Microsoft promotes what they're doing as a best of both worlds scenario, no compromises and everything. You know, critics will tell you that it is nothing but a compromise and whatever. I don't follow this as closely as I do the Windows world, but it wouldn't surprise me to discover that there are people on the Mac side of the fence who aren't too happy about some of these iOS-type things that are in Mac OS X. I bet there are people who, you know, don't like that, don't like how that thing is infringing on this product that they really like. And I guess I understand that, but I would also tell those people that It's even worse in Windows. So, you know, if you don't like that stuff, you're kind of screwed. You know?
It could be worse. Yeah.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, you know, when you look at these two things side by side and you compare, the deeper you get into it, just from a user experience standpoint, when you look at the apps and what the apps do, you know, actually, the bar hasn't moved at all. I mean, Windows and OS X are very comparable, you know, Mountain Lion versus Windows 8. I mean, they have many of the same things. You know, for example, Windows 8 has this notion, because Windows 8 Metro apps are isolated from each other physically on the disk, but also, you know, from a code standpoint, memory standpoint, and so forth, they have to introduce new ways of doing things like copy and paste and so forth. So there's something that we call the share contract, which is implemented between apps that, you know, can register themselves with the system and say, I can share this kind of information, or I can accept this kind of information from another app that's sharing. And so the canonical example of that is you're looking at a web page and you're like, oh, I'd like to share this with somebody. And so you implement, you bring up the charm bar and you hit share. And depending on the apps that you have installed in your system, you'll see different options. The one that's built into the consumer preview is mail. So you can share a web page via mail. You can share just the page. It'll be like a link with a little blurb. You can select some of the text on the page, and it will actually put that text into the email. You can do different things like that. Coming in the release preview, you'll be able to share over social networking services like Facebook and Twitter and so forth, and you'll be able to do, you know, there'll be more apps that support share as well. When you look at Mountain Lion has added the share feature that's in iOS to the browser as well, the Safari browser. The icon for it looks just like it does on iOS. It's that little square with the arrow coming out of it, you know, so if you want to do something else with this thing. And it has options in there that are kind of like what you would see in Safari on iOS. So you can share, you can email the web page like you can in Windows 8, or you can send it through iMessage, right, with like instant messaging or a text message style thing and so forth. So it implemented in completely different ways, but ways that are fairly consistent for those environments, you know, that work with as they do on other platforms that those companies make. So I think it's interesting. I mean, I guess there's that one big high level difference. And then the more into specifics to get, the more you realize, well, it's actually fairly similar. You know, Apple has AirPlay, right? Microsoft has the Play-2 stuff, which is DLNA based. It's fairly unintelligent, but it works with any DLNA compatible device. But if you want to do something that works like, say, blasting an iPad-based video to your Apple TV on the HDTV, Microsoft has something called Play on Xbox in Windows 8. So you're using a Windows 8 or Windows RT tablet instead of an iPad, and you're using an Xbox 360 instead of an Apple TV, and it works exactly the same way. Very interesting, and an interesting alternative, I guess, to the stuff that Apple's doing.
You know, Apple took a lot of hits on the new Apple TV because it didn't work the same way. They made it, flattened it. Kind of like...
Did it? What do you mean?
They changed all the icons to flat icons.
Oh, the UI. Yeah.
The UI got changed.
I heard that Steve Jobs hated that UI, and I can see why. It's like a grid of icons.
Yeah. And they iOS... Probably what they did is they iOS'd it.
They iOS'd it, yeah. Well, I think some people see this as the coming of...
stupidity.
You know, apps. Well, no, but in other words, maybe apps will be coming. There'll be an app store for Apple TV.
Right. I see it as the coming of the dumbing.
The dumbening.
Yeah, Apple the dumbening. Okay. Yeah.
That could be.
I like that. Have we used the dumbening? I like the dumbening.
Yeah. This is a term I've unfortunately used.
More than once?
For Windows 8.
The dumbening.
The dumbening. It's like a Highlander movie.
It is. There can be but one.
The dummy.
The
there can be but dumb.
There can be but dumb.
There can be only dumb. So, anyway, I don't know. You know, I think these things are going to come out and they're going to be roughly comparable. I mean, I don't think there's going to be Apple has their own style. Obviously, Microsoft has a new style now, this new Metro style. Never the twain shall meet. But they're...
Doesn't Metro mean a man who is kind of... has certain kind of feminine features.
Ambiguous, we would say.
Ambiguous, like a guy who gets a pedicure.
No, I believe in this context they're referring to like subway and transportation systems, like a
much more macho than the androgynous operating system.
I'm pretty sure they're not shooting for the end. Like it's not the Boy George operating system. I think.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry?
Yes, Leo.
Moving along on our outline. By the way, you've because no Mary Jo today, you've jammed, you packed this full of goodness.
I did.
And our next topic is a short one we can do quickly. It won't take very long. I'm going to allow 2 minutes for the future of the PC.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's a side conversation that gets attached to this because you may recall after New Year's we did some resolution type stuff, and every year I kind of reevaluate my environment. I mean, there's a health aspect to it too. I mean, I talk about losing weight and all that kind of stuff, but I look at all the technology.
I just want to say that the chat room sucks. They're so mean. Somebody said, was Boy George in the outline? Another person said, did you spend all your candy money on their music lessons on candy, Leo? I mean, this is a mean, mean chat room. All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, it's like we're working off a script. No, we ad lib here.
We do make stuff up, like singing Boy George songs.
This was not prearranged. We did not practice that.
Can you tell? Yeah. Can you tell? I'm sorry. The future of the PC. Okay. Let's go back.
One of the things that I assumed I would be doing this year was be moving to more of a more mobile type of scenario. You know, I've always had a desktop computer. The computer I've been using for many years now is three processor generations old. It's a Core 2 Quad. There have been three generations of Core processors that have occurred since then, and I've kind of resisted upgrading that one machine. I upgrade my laptops fairly frequently, because I travel a lot, and that's one way to keep up on that stuff. But, you know, when push came to shove this spring, as has been the case with a lot of my resolutions technology-wise, I kind of just went back to the way I was doing it before, even given my best intentions, you know. And I ended up buying a very high-end Core i7 processor-based desktop computer.
Isn't that funny? Old habits die hard.
I can justify it in various ways, but
it might be your last. It might be your last PC.
It might be. You know, one of the other things I said to you was I told you I bought my last point-and-click camera.
I remember that.
Right.
Yep.
And then it broke. And now I don't. Now I don't know.
So now you need
I'm not ready.
That doesn't count.
I know, but you see how these things work, right? Yeah. I mean, you go in with the best of intentions, but
that doesn't.
I would tell people are always asking me about, should I buy an Ultrabook now? Should I buy this one? Should I get this?
I showed you a couple of Ultrabooks. I have the Dell and the Acer, and I think these are spectacular. I do too. And I keep saying, oh, I want to just use the iPad. But it's not there yet. It's making its way there, but it's not there yet.
You know, Apple could do one simple thing that would make the iPad more acceptable for people that need to use it for productivity. It'd be the simplest thing in the world. I bet they don't do it. But here's the one thing that would improve this thing immeasurably.
What's that?
I don't know what they call it on the Mac keyboard, but add the ability to do Alt-Tab app switching. Right?
Well, they have a gesture. They have a
I don't want to touch it. In other words, I'm writing, and I need to refer to a web article or another document. So what I need to do is switch quickly between two apps. I accept that this small screen can only show me one app at a time. Okay,
but you need quick context switching. That makes sense. Yes. Although they don't provide a keyboard either. The keyboard is completely an after.
Think that, you know, with the keyboard that Apple has, which is the same keyboard they have on their laptop computers, or one of the many keyboard cases that people are making where it's more of a seamless thing, right? It's not the goofy guy pulling out every iPad accessory on earth out of his bag like an idiot.
Right.
It's, you can buy this kind of laptop-like thing. I mean, I think for a lot of people, that would be enough. But they just don't have that ability to do app switching from the keyboard. That alone, I think, would make a big difference. But this is where I think the PC space is going to fill in the gaps because, of course, on the PC side of the fence, you get diversity, both price ranges and companies, but also form factors and so forth. And I think that, once Windows 8 is said and done, that the PC market of, say, a year from now is going to look very different from the one that we have today. On the desktop computer side, obviously, all-in-one computers are the big deal now. Everyone is coming out with these things. They all look a lot like the iMac, which is not a coincidence. And I resisted that. I mean, I to me, you know, a computer built into the screen reminds me of those VCRs built into the TV or whatever. I was always nervous that one part of the chain was going to break and then rendering the rest of it useless. Like, I kind of like having a screen that's separate, you know, from the computer. And I'm happy with the, I would be happy with a small form factor device. In fact, I think one of the other big, well, within the confines of the desktop PC space, one of the big trends is going to be in these tiny PCs, like the one that Lenovo just launched, where this thing is, you know, maybe 3/4 the size of a Mac Mini, you know, very small, something you could mount right on the back of a screen, in fact, and basically emulate an iMac. I think that's going to be a big deal. But I think the bigger deal is, of course, the portable stuff. And I think that people using tablet computers, like slate-type computers that look like iPads, where they carry that thing around with them and they use all the Metro apps and everything, but then they get to work or home and they dock it and they have a keyboard and a mouse and a big screen and a webcam and all that stuff. I think that's going to transform the way that people work. And I do think that's going to be a big deal. That said, we're not in a horrible place right now. I mean, I travel with a 3-pound Ultrabook, 13-inch screen. It's got a crazy resolution. It's like 1600 by 900. Unbelievably light, wonderful.
This is the Asus that you like.
Yeah, the ZenBook. It's such a great machine, other than the keyboard, which is just kind of middling. And I don't think that's a big deal for most people. I mean, I type a lot, you know. The new version of it that's coming out any day now has a much better keyboard. So I'm not going to upgrade it. I don't think it's worth it. You know, I'm not going to spend another $1,500. But I mean, they've already improved it. So there you go.
There's one coming out that I'm really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
The Lenovo, the ThinkPad X1 Carbon. It's 14 inches and it's Ivy Bridge. 1600 by 900.
Is the X1 technically an ultrabook? I'm not even sure.
They're calling it an ultrabook.
They are calling it. Yeah. Okay, I don't think they did last year.
Inches. It is ultra portable.
That's beautiful.
3.0 pounds.
Great. Obviously, great. The greatest keyboard.
Lenovo's always had great keyboards.
Yeah, they're backlit now. They've switched completely to this new keyboard. By the way. So a couple of years ago, they introduced this low-impact keyboard. You know, one of the problems with the classic ThinkPad keyboard is that it's just a little too thick.
Right.
So you can't put it into a really thin and light machine. So they came up with this, their take on an island keyboard, or I don't know what they call it. But I've really grown to love it. And it's funny. I think early on, the first year or two of it, I would have said that it's great. But, it's second to the classic Lenovo keyboard. But when you go back to the old one now, when I do anyway, I actually prefer the new one. You know, I think once you get used to it, it's just a better keyboard. I would say that that's got to be the best keyboard. Laptop Magazine last year said that the original X1 had the best keyboard they've ever used on any laptop.
Now, what's
ever.
The resolution on your Zen?
1600 by 900.
Okay, so that's also what they're going to do on this Lenovo, the X1. So
yeah, that's a good
one. I know
you
want high resolution. That's as high as you can get, probably. Of course, this is a 14-inch screen. It's a bigger
screen. Actually, that's good. I think that's good. I would say on the 13-inch screen, it's a little too small for me.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
That high res, that small of a screen, maybe 14 inches would be.
That's Retina. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. Lenovo is also coming out with, I believe, a T-class Ultrabook in the fall. And they're going to have hybrids and slates and all that stuff as well. So I just say it's just interesting, and the other issue.
But it is crazy to buy something now when the Windows 8's coming out, and that's going to change. Well, you're going to want touch, aren't you?
Unless you don't want Windows 8. See, that's the thing. I think there's a pretty good segment of the population. I would say if you're not that excited about Windows 8, or at least not that excited about the touch capabilities of Windows 8, this is a different time than it was last fall. I mean, that first generation of Ultrabooks that we had, say, last September, October, were not particularly interesting. It got a little interesting over the holidays, and beyond that, I bought this one, I think, in January. This current crop of machines, I think we've reached an interesting point where there are a lot of excellent choices, and I could see, it's going to be hard for me not to buy one this year. I'm going to try to wait until Windows 8, but there's some good ones, definitely. The other thing that's related to this, by the way, is, you know, when SSDs came out, of course, the first ones you would see in a mainstream laptop were probably 64 gigabytes, and then today 128 is very, very common. It's probably 90% of them. 256 is starting to come down finally. These even at 256, though, that's a far cry from the massive sizes you would see in laptops a year or two ago. You know, I think the last Lenovo that I bought that had a hard drive in it came with probably a 500 gig hard drive somewhere in there. And I think I updated it to a 750 at one point, hybrid hard drive. When you go from a hard drive like that to a 128 gig SSD, you got to change the way you do things. You know what I mean? Like you're not taking your entire media collection with you anymore. You're not taking this or that, And so, for a while there, it seemed like, my approach was to bring an external hard drive. And for those really big things that I would only use occasionally, like, maybe some movies or TV shows or something like that, you could access them off the hard drive. But, the side trend that has been growing right along this with Ultrabooks and these smaller capacity drives is the cloud storage stuff. Apple's got iCloud, Microsoft now has SkyDrive, and they're going to expand that into media stuff very soon. Google obviously has their stuff, and they have a music-specific service. Amazon has a music-specific service. I think between cellular capabilities that will be built into these machines and the monthly data plans you get with that, or just MiFi-type data, or just Wi-Fi in whatever situation you're in, we're suddenly in a place where the capacity, as long as it's a certain amount, 64 is probably pushing it, but 128 I think is fine, almost doesn't matter anymore. It's an interesting confluence of things where, for a lot of people, the storage...
Because so much is in the cloud?
Yeah. You can just keep the cloud. Yeah. You can...
How big is Windows 8? Do we know?
How big is Windows 8? Like on the disk?
Yeah. How much space do I need for the operating system?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I can find it out quickly. I'm not sure. I'm sorry. It's
anybody
not
in the
that,
chat room now?
You can install it on a disk that's as small as 30. Actually, you can install it on one that's as small as 16.
Web 1226 says 12 gigs. I think that's too big. Dr. T says about 6.5 gigs.
Well, I know
12,
that for
12. Everybody's saying 12.
Yeah, for WinRT, the smallest solid state storage you could get is going to be 16. And that's ridiculous. I mean,
free room.
That's like those netbooks were when they first came out. It's too small. But yeah, I think 64 might be common on those types of devices. And then I think for the Intel stuff, you're going to see 128 and 256. But that combined with cloud storage, all of a sudden it doesn't matter anymore.
Acer, they're doing something interesting. They have a hybrid drive. They have a 20 gig SSD. And then a 250 or 500 gig.
I don't know.
I don't know about that either. Yeah,
I it's a cost thing. Obviously, the problem is when you have both of those in there, that means that device by nature could be a little thicker than it has to be if it was just an SSD or just solid state.
No, I think it's a single drive that does. They're making these.
Oh,
hybrids.
A single drive that does both.
They're making these hybrids now. Yeah.
However, 32 gigs of SSD, and then
The benchmarks I've seen on the hybrids have not been good. I haven't seen any lately, though.
I bought one hybrid drive, and I thought nothing of it. It never seemed to perform any better than the hard drive it replaced. I didn't think it was a big deal. It was a while ago, but I just wasn't. Once you go to an SSD, installed Windows 8 on this machine, the one I'm using now, put the SSD in it, this thing boots, or it's a little longer now, actually, but, when I first installed Windows, it booted from a cold stop in 6 seconds. Six.
You get totally spoiled.
Yeah.
Totally spoiled.
If you could tell me that like a hybrid drive could boot in like 16 or 20, I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, big deal. I want more.
Six.
Yeah. You do get spoiled, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, so somebody's getting all excited in the chat room.
Okay.
About the Samsung Series 9.
Yes, there is a 15-inch version of that.
Yep. It's 1600 by 900, 256 hard drive, 8 gigs of RAM. i7, and I presume because it's coming out in mid-June, it's the Ivy Bridge. I think you're going to see a flood of Ivy Bridge notebooks.
Yeah.
Because the Ivy Bridge is out, but the mobile parts won't come out until June, and I think that's what everybody's waiting for.
So that machine, they're going to sell in Best Buy. That's the type of machine I need to go see in person.
Samsung is so aggressive. They are owning the market right now.
Yeah, and the style of that machine he's referring to is very similar to the Asus I have. Let's see if I can do this easily. If you look at the side of it,
Paul is now holding up a computer.
It has
pretty.
This kind of it looks just like
it's
this.
Tapered.
Yeah, it's got a.
They're all tapered because you can't get all the electronics in the thinness, so they look thin because they're all wedges.
Right.
In fact, I think it was HP, the guy at HP, who when people said, you're just copying the MacBook Air, he said, "Dudes, you have to make it this way. It has to be a wedge."
I would say, obviously, the first three Ultrabooks that came out last fall were absolutely MacBook Air ripoffs. Yeah. This one I have is absolutely a MacBook Air ripoff. But, you know, that Dell has a style all to its own. The new HPs, the Ultrabooks they have, and what they're calling sleek books, which are Ultrabooks that don't quite meet some, you know, Ultrabook requirement. They all have a style of their own. I mean, I think we're finally starting to see that. The original version of the Samsung Series 9.
It's made out of Duralumin.
Yes, it is.
Duralumin.
It's made by leprechauns.
It's a new material, the same kind of material used in advanced aircraft.
It sure is. So stupid, you know.
Duralumin.
Is it made out of something light? Because that's really what I care about.
Yeah. It's twice as strong as aluminum, but light. It's just aluminum with, you know, strong
made
aluminum.
By the DuPont Corporation?
Yeah, DuPont aluminum. I don't know. And it's got 400 nits.
You got to have the nits.
Oh, without the nits, what do you got?
Darkness, I guess.
Huh? Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, the question is this your last desktop? Or I mean, a laptop is...
I don't want to say anymore. I try to change the way I do things.
I don't think it is. I think that they're making these laptops more and more compelling. I don't think I'll buy another desktop. In fact, I have, you know, a very high-end i7 Mac Pro in my house, and I use the laptop, the Air, most of the time, just because it's convenient, it's light, I can bring it around, and I don't need all the power of the desktop.
I bring my desktop out to the couch all the time. Why is that?
The only reason it would be for dual, you know, 30-inch or 27-inch, I guess dual 27-inch monitors. Is that what people want anymore?
Some people. There'll always be a market for trucks. It's just going to be a smaller market.
Programmers use those.
Yeah.
I can't. I'm trying to justify it. I can't. I really want to buy.
The problem is you get used to, you know, you get to use this. I have a 27-inch screen. You get used to it. And then you go on the road with this 13-inch thing, and it's like looking at a postage stamp. You know, you don't even. It's
frustrating. But why doesn't the tablet do that to us?
Well, because the tablet, you know, I think the tablet by its nature, because of its form factor, a lot of those are going to be sold with docks, you know. Apple doesn't do docks. They have a very awkward, well, they have a cable now, I guess. You know, they have their own thing that they do. But
no,
you know,
they don't do docks.
They've never had this notion of docks. Even in the Lenovo world, you know, only the professional level ThinkPads have docks. And they're okay. But I think there's something to be said for this thing that's a little slab. You can plug it into a dock, and you don't really use that screen anymore. You just use the big screen, you know. And plus, you're doing something a little different than you are when you're just carrying the device. And I think that's always been the flaw with the laptop docking thing, which is that when you dock a laptop, you're looking at exactly the same thing, but maybe now it's in a different resolution on a bigger screen, and it kind of screws things up when you go back and forth. On these devices, I think a lot of people will use them purely in the metro mode when they're walking around, just like they use an iPad. But when they plug it into that dock, they're going to go to the desktop, and they're going to use Microsoft Word or Visual Studio or whatever it is they use. And so I think it's, you know, it's a subtle thing, but I think it makes a difference, because I just think there's a weirdness to docking a laptop oftentimes, unless you can match the resolution and so forth. And it's not a great experience going back and forth. But I think with the tablet, because you're essentially doing two different things, it will give you that best of both worlds, or potentially can, where it is the equivalent of two different devices. Because, you know, when you're holding it, it's Metro. But when you're docked, it's the desktop. Maybe. We'll see.
You want to talk about Windows, Xbox 360 before we get to your tip?
Yeah, you know, this is another thing I haven't written up yet, but it has been in my mind lately. You know, obviously I'm kind of a Microsoft-focused guy, in case you didn't know.
Really?
But one of the things that we do, and we don't really think about it too much, or like, why do we do this, is, you know, we use the Apple stuff for media, right? So for TV shows and movies and music, we're using the Apple stuff. And I think in the next, you know, few months or whatever, the Microsoft stuff is going to get there for music. But the truth is, today, with an Xbox 360, which we also have in the living room, which I've been trying to use lately to try to wrap my head around where this thing competes with the Apple TV. You know, it's actually sort of amazing how far this thing has come in the past year. Obviously, it plays video games, but just thinking about it purely from a set-top box perspective, you know, as a thing that is attached to your HDTV, where you can do things like watch Netflix or Hulu Plus or HBO Go or, you know, Fios if you have that, which we do here, where you can rent and buy, although I don't know why you would, but you can rent, certainly rent movies, buy TV shows and watch them in HD through the Xbox 360. Soon there will be a better implementation of the music stuff as well. And so you have this notion of this thing that is basically the equivalent of what Apple does. So, what, you know, why aren't I using this? There are actually some advantages on the Microsoft side. They do a much better job of streaming HD up front, where it's kind of an interesting process where it starts off in SD and the quality gets better over the first, say, 30 seconds. And from the time that you press go, it starts up basically immediately. And that stuff is actually surprisingly nice. I think a lot of people just don't look at it. It's still branded as Zune Movie Marketplace or Zune TV, whatever, you know, and that will be going away. But it's basically just Microsoft's Marketplace, you know, or they might call it Xbox Marketplace or whatever they're going to call it. But that stuff is kind of right there. The one place where it falls apart for me personally is with the captioning. I just did this last night. I went through looking for captioning. It's funny, when you look at their movies, whether you're going to rent or buy them, it will say, you know, 5.1 surround in English without captioning. It actually says there's no captioning.
Well,
Yeah. I did not find a single instance of captioning outside of foreign movies that are captioned. So
it does have the capability.
It absolutely does.
Well, that subtitle's not closed captioning.
Yeah.
So I think that is different.
Okay.
The subtitles are burned into the movie.
Right. This is an area where Apple's done a much better job, and it's only gotten better over time. And when you go to the Apple TV, to the music, to the movie or TV stuff today, you would be hard-pressed to find something that wasn't captioned today.
Really? It's on Apple TV? Better. That's fantastic.
Yeah, much better than it used to be. A lot of the related services or side services that are not made by that company, you know, Netflix and so forth. Actually, Netflix, their streaming stuff now has a lot of captioning.
Really?
And that works on,
fantastic.
Yep, works on Apple TV. It works on the Xbox. It's all there. So that's just a need that I have. You know, my son is deaf and we need captioning. But, you know, I think for most people, for many people, maybe that wouldn't be an issue. So I'm going to re-examine the Xbox 360, hopefully with fresh eyes. I'm curious to hear from people that are using it in this way. Obviously, over the past year, Microsoft has done a lot to improve the media apps situation on there. There's some social stuff that I don't really care about, but they've added, you know, Xfinity's on there now and Fios and all kinds of different services. And just sort of try to use it. You kind of get used to just doing it a certain way. I have in my office here, you know, when Apple upgraded to the 1080p version of the Apple TV, I bought one. I put it out in the den. You can't really tell the difference, to be honest. I mean, we have a pretty big HDTV, but I never did side by sides, but I mean, the movie's still
1080p looks good. I think it looks really good.
Okay.
And I'm putting in a 120-inch screen. I'll let you know.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough.
You'll probably notice it there. I'm thinking.
Yeah. Fair enough. I put the old one in my office. You can see my exercise equipment behind me. So I've got a TV up on the wall.
Right.
And it's connected to an Apple TV, and it's playing content that's off of my computer.
Right.
And every single day, every single time I use it, I have to futz around with it.
Yeah.
It's on the wireless network. It won't. I go to, you know, hit my computer, and it doesn't see it. So I have to come over to my computer, turn off iTunes, turn it back on. I fight with it every single day, you know,
yeah,
and I think to myself, I have an Xbox 360 in my office as well. I bet if I plug this thing in, it would just work, you know, like I've been sort of defending my use of this stuff for a long time for various reasons. But I'm beginning to wonder, you know, if there isn't a better way to do this. So it's something I'm going to experiment with anyway, certainly.
Good.
It seems like it's there.
It is, you know, I mean, it's a topic that we keep talking about on all of our shows. We, you know, it's cord cutting and the best ways to use devices to get. I think everybody's doing it. Although I think there's no question in my mind that everything's moving to streaming. That nobody's going to store
this
stuff
before. If I didn't have kids, I pretty much wouldn't have cable. I mean, I don't.
Right.
You
don't need media anymore, and you don't really need a Windows Home Server or something to store all your media content. You just stream it all.
So you see what that is, right? I just mentioned how that works for an individual with an SSD on a laptop. In the same way, it can work for an entire household, right? I mean, you don't have to have this stuff.
That's the point.
You know, it's like we ferret this stuff away like squirrels,
we don't,
like with the winter coming.
Yeah, but, the end of the hoarder.
Yeah, We don't need to do that.
Nope.
It requires some work. You have to, A, you have to accept it, you know, right. And then you have to just do it.
Right.
But and the services are evolving. I mean, it's not all there yet. Certainly from the music standpoint, I paid for iTunes Match. I'm not even positive I have a local copy of my music collection per se. I mean, obviously it downloads it every time you play anything, but I sort of download it as I play it. You know, we had people coming over. We wanted some instrumental music. I brought the iPhone out, plugged it into the stereo we have in the kitchen, set it to play this thing. It wasn't on the phone. It just kind of downloaded it as it played. And, you know, it wasn't like it sat there. There was no buffering or pausing or glitching. It just worked, you know? That's pretty amazing because I used to spend a lot of time, and I think people still do, managing the content that was on every single device. You would sort of, you know, compulsively plug it in and sync all the time, right? Every day. It's nice to not have to worry about that.
So awesome.
Yeah.
So awesome. Thank you.
I think so.
Thank you, Bill Gates or whoever. Whoever you are.
I don't think it was Bill Gates, but...
You know, what's interesting is how fast everything's moving. I mean, this is a massive transformation already from, physical media to stored media to streaming media in a matter of a few years.
Yep.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, and every time I have this conversation, somebody writes in to remind me that in the rural part of Australia where they live, they don't have broadband.
Right.
I get it. I mean, right. I'm not, it's not
we,
universal
we understand.
Yet. It's a transition. I know that.
We understand.
I do. I mean, I get it.
It's not everywhere.
But you know, by the way, even here, right, we live outside of Boston. I mean, just the way that wireless has changed in the past year, like cellular wireless. When I got the original iPhone, it was on like an edge connection. It was terrible. AT&T was roundly criticized for having awful connectivity no matter where they were. You know, they evolved it. They pushed 3G. Mm-hmm. LTE. Now, I get LTE in my house. I live in a dead zone. I get LTE everywhere I go around Boston. I never have the connectivity problems that I used to always have. Even in the past year, it's gotten much better. Even since Windows Phone 7.5 launched, when that first generation of HSPA, whatever those were called, phones launched back in October, November, switch to a Lumia 900, or you could get an HTC Titan 2 or that new Samsung Focus 2 and have LTE with a tethering plan. You know, I used at the developer event I went to, Wi-Fi, notably bad at these Microsoft events. I tethered the entire day over the Lumia. It was great. I was online.
That's
I posted
amazing.
Articles.
I mean, that's a breakthrough. That's mind-boggling.
It's not that you know, tethering is new. But it was LTE tethering,
right?
It's like it's feasible.
Huge.
It makes sense. You know, it works. I connect to my work-related forums where I post articles, and it doesn't sit there and spin a circle for a while. It just posts. It just works.
It's so much.
No, I mean, it's a little thing.
No, it's huge.
It makes all the difference.
It's a huge thing.
Yeah, it is huge.
If you ask me.
Yeah,
it's a transformation, and you know we're like that frog in the kettle. It just we're not aware of it,
right? We are like a frog in a kettle.
We're like a frog in a kettle. Just in case anybody was curious, that's what we're like. We just have to stop because we have too many good show names.
Yep.
We could just stop being clever now. But let us.
You know what it's like, Leo?
What is it like, Paul? No, it's like being brilliant, but no one knows it.
Yes, that's a problem we all suffer from.
No one knows it. Our picks of the week, ladies and gentlemen, start with a tip, why don't we? Beautiful new wallpaper for your Lumia and other Windows phones.
Yeah, I have a link to this. A photographer in London, I believe, was contacted by Microsoft. He had some beautiful wallpaper. It's the first time that Microsoft has offered official wallpapers for Windows Phone. And this is kind of a neat way. You can actually hold your phone up to that image, see, it's got the barcode thing there.
And so you can see. So this is on Supersite for Windows, folks, for those of you listening at home at winsupersite.com. And it's got a barcode, a QR code. And what I like about these wallpapers is they're long. They're wide.
So here's the thing. So actually, they're not. The one you get on the phone is just the middle bit.
Oh.
And so I thought, that's too bad. Well, hold on a second. So the guy who provided these, the guy who took these photos, contacted me on Twitter, and he's going to make the full versions available.
Thank you.
Because I had made a comment where I said, you know, these the widescreen versions of these would be beautiful on your desktop. And I could see people wanting the same imagery.
Have both,
on both. And he said, I am going to release them on the desktop.
So a question for you. So Windows Phone, when I scroll left or right, can't scroll the desktop left or right with it.
So, yeah, the way Microsoft, it's funny.
Because Android will do this. Android will do that. And then I like wide ones for Android. It'd be great.
Yes. I also would want it wide simply because you may want a different part of it.
Right.
You
might want the ladybug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Microsoft's deal with scrolling on the phone is that they feel that the correct way to scroll is toward the longest axis of the device.
Uh-huh.
And so when you think about the Windows 8
up
home
down,
screen.
Not left, right.
A start screen, it goes left, right because people typically look at the screen in landscape mode.
Right.
But when you're holding a phone, typically in portrait mode, up down seems to be the correct way for that, although that doesn't explain the hubs in Windows 8, Windows Phone, does it? So that's their answer, but whatever.
You know, I agree with you. It's interesting. Flipboard would agree with you. On the iPad, Flipboard goes left, right, and on the iPhone, it goes up, down. And it is a better metaphor, actually.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Well, it's
sense.
Like the...
you go the long axis.
The notification bar. That,
yeah, it should come from the top.
That Apple has.
Because you have all that space.
But on the Mac, they do it on the side. So the second one, this one I don't have an article for, but it just occurred to me. I had recently updated my What I Use article, and I get funny questions from people, you know. Don't mind the beeping. That's my computer about to explode. I have a I don't know if you can hear that. But
I do hear it. It sounds like your tea is on.
No, it's my universal power supply, which is...
It means your power's out, so if you suddenly go away, I'll know why.
No, my power's fine. There's something wrong with it. It's really old, and I need to replace it. It's going to stop.
It needs a new battery, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sorry about that.
It's very quiet. It doesn't bother me.
No, I'm sorry.
But if there are any dogs listening, they're going crazy right now.
Right. Anyway, it will stop eventually. Yeah. So someone, you know, I get these questions from people. They read what I write and they say, well, you wrote this thing and it's very interesting, but you didn't say this or that. You know, they'll discuss things. For one guy said, do you ride a bicycle? What type of bike is it? You know? I do ride a bicycle.
Inquiring minds want to know, Paul. Everything about you.
So that's
boxers or briefs. What we got to know.
Right. So the tip is not about boxers or briefs or my bicycle, but it is about something I actually use really regularly in Windows and I think is a very useful feature. So starting in IE9, Microsoft provided the ability to pin a website from IE, from the address bar, down to the taskbar and have it appear as its own icon. And then you could launch its own window, right? Similar to the Chrome feature where you can have right. It's beautiful. So I have one down there for Facebook and I have, you know, my mail and so forth. But there's actually a related feature that I find very useful. So, for example, one of the first things that I pin when I reinstall Windows is I go to Hotmail because I use that as my primary personal email. And I drag that thing down and I pin it. But I also have work email. So what I do is I open that Hotmail window and actually I have to go to it just to see what it looks like. And I open a new tab, load my work email, and then you can go over to the home button, which in this kind of IE window uses the icon from the website. And you right-click that, and you say add as homepage. And now every time you open that mail icon, you get one window with two tabs for both of your email programs in one window.
Ooh.
Right. So one of the other ways I use it is I use Google Reader and Google News and also Twitter. And I have those all attached just to one window. So I'll go to Google Reader first. It just happens to have a nicer looking icon. And then I add as a homepage those two other window, you know, tabs that I want to attach to that. And you could picture different ways to do that. You might maybe have one that's Facebook and Twitter or, you know, however you want to use your computer, obviously, is up to you. But there are different ways to do it. And it's actually a really useful feature. It's something I've never actually written about, but it's basically a combination of two IE features because IE allows you to have multiple home pages on multiple tabs. And now in IE 9 or IE 10, you can pin sites that have special icons and you can kind of cluster them in little tab groups. I don't know what to call the feature exactly, but it's a neat thing. And I use it all the time. I've just never really described it or written about it for whatever reason. So maybe I will.
Well, it's about time. I've been waiting. But
sorry.
But now I want to know one thing. What kind of bicycle?
It's a Trek 700.
There you go. That's all we ask. It's simple, Paul.
That.
We're not asking a lot.
Why do I know that?
Why do you know that? Because you ride it.
Why do I know what kind of bike I have?
It's between your legs.
I've never even looked at it. I have no idea what it is. But this guy wrote me an email. So what kind of bike do you ride?
Yeah.
So I went out to the garage and looked at it. I had no idea.
You didn't even know the name, the brand name?
Well, I knew it was a Trek, but oh, I it's 2 years old.
No, I wouldn't know what model of bike I ride.
I just, like, I don't know.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
Software pick of the week.
So I have two of these as well.
You're an overachiever, Facebook. Paul. Let's just face it.
Well, Mary Jo's not here. I feel like I have to fill in the gaps.
All right.
Facebook 2.5 is out for Windows Phone. I've talked before in the past about the need for the Facebook app, even though Windows Phone has integrated Facebook functionality, because the app does a lot of stuff that the integrated functionality doesn't, and it's updated more often, of course. This new version gets some stuff that I don't know. I'm looking down the list. I don't know that much of this is stuff I ever really noticed wasn't there. But you can manage your wall from here. You can tag a better tagging. So you can, it uses the standard format. So you can say, you know, Paul was tagged with Bob at, you know, this place, that kind of thing. It's basically just bringing it up to date with, you know, the way Facebook is on the web, or maybe even on other devices. But the Facebook app on Windows 5 is actually pretty nice. I mean, they have like a nice banner image you can have, which is very similar to that. I don't know what they call it, cover image or whatever they use on Facebook. It's a great app. So it was finally just updated. They were talking about this maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they finally did release it. So be sure to get that. If you are using it, upgrade it. If you're not, get it. It's free.
Get it. It's good.
It's good.
And speaking of good, The Walking Dead.
Yeah, this is also falls within the lines of trying to, you know, change the way I do things. You know, basically the past couple of years, the way things have worked video game wise is a new Call of Duty game comes out, and then Paul plays that game for the next year. You know, I'm trying to branch out a little bit. So I was looking at what was available, and, you know, there's a wonderful aspect to Xbox Live that I think a lot of people do know about, but I also believe a lot of people don't know about, which is that there's something called Xbox Live Arcade, which is a place where Microsoft allows developers to release smaller games electronically only. You download them from the interwebs, and they're usually a lot cheaper. They still have achievements, you know, not as many as a full game, obviously. Games of varying quality, but I mean, I was talking to Raphael about this the other day. There's an amazing game called Fez, for example, which I've just started looking at, but The Walking Dead came out over the past week, and it's a serial game, so the first part is available now. It's $5, and there are going to be four more parts, also $5. It's, you know, I would say value for the money. It's pretty good. I mean, if you're familiar with The Walking Dead and how it came about, you know that it was a graphic novel to begin with. And it sort of apes that style. It's a colorized 3D-ish version of the comic book, essentially. It doesn't follow the actual plot of the comic book. It's a side story, another story that takes place at the exact same time. So it begins with guy leaving Atlanta just as the zombie apocalypse hits, parallels the events in the comic book and thus also the TV show. You know, really well done. I describe it in the review I wrote as the modern version of one of those Sierra Online games like King's Quest, you know, where a lot of it is just walking around, talking to people, making decisions. But I think it's not like a hackathon. It's not you're not running around shooting things and running them over with lawnmowers like maybe you did in some of the other zombie games on the Xbox 360, but no, that's not it.
No idea what you're talking about.
That's not the game, Leo.
Oh, what? Oh, hi, Paul.
Anyway, this is a neat game, and I finished this. And I'll play at least the next one. We'll see.
Do you have to have seen the TV show or the comic books?
Not at all. No, it's complete. It's you know, some
and
of
it's not Left for Dead. I mean, it's not a zombie killer.
No.
See, that's what I would have assumed, right?
Actually, the one innovative bit in here, and I'm taking this with a grain of salt because I'm not going to go back and test it. Is you make decisions, and the decisions you make affect both what happens in the game, i.e., who lives and dies in some cases, who likes you, who doesn't like you, you know, whether people trust you. No, but it actually impacts the flow of the game. I'm not going to go back and, you know, change my decisions to see how it works. They give you a neat chart at the end where they show you how you compare to the rest of the world with your decision making. You know, in other words, there's at one point you do have to choose between two characters, and, you know, 76, you know, chose the woman and 24 chose the guy, I guess. I thought that was kind of interesting, but Some of it's a little tedious. You know, we have a radio that doesn't work. We need to find two batteries. And you walk around like a jerk waiting until you find something that looks like a battery, you know. And once you do, then the plot can continue. I mean, I think that's kind of standard fare for the graphic adventure genre, you know.
It's just a nice presentation.
Fun. Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people just love it. I happen to be.
It's kind of retro.
Yes. And obviously, I play a lot of Call of Duty type games.
So yeah, you want a refreshing break.
This is a is a change. For me, this is a change. I liked it a lot. I actually think a lot of people will like this a lot. It's certainly inexpensive.
Hellcat says it's also on Steam. I don't know if it's $5 on Steam.
I am amused to discover that people still play games on computers.
If I'm not mistaken,
Diablo 3 is only available on computers, right? That's not on consoles.
Yeah, right now it's not on consoles.
So there you go.
Yeah. And finally, I know you probably wanted to do this maybe as part of an Audible ad or something, but I think you should be able to.
This is not an Audible. So okay. Actually, I threw this in. We don't have an Audible.
Just a book
ad.
Pick. Just a book pick.
Yeah. This is amazing. I was firmly invested in the Amiga, and this maybe means a lot more to me than it will to some people. But there are books about the history of Commodore. There's a coming book about the history of the Amiga phase of Commodore. This book, which is called The Future Was Here, which is a take on the line "The Future Is Here," which was the title story of the first issue of Amiga World.
Oh, interesting.
About the technologies that were in the Amiga and the things that differentiated the Amiga from other platforms and why over time those differentiators actually became a liability. It is an amazing thing. And I didn't quite understand at first what I was reading, because in the beginning, there's a very quick history of the early days of the Amiga, Incorporated, the company that was later bought by Commodore. And I thought to myself, you know, they're really blowing through some stuff here. This doesn't seem like a good history of this company at all. And then I realized that's not what the book was about. And they devote individual chapters to topics that are incredibly important to the Amiga. I mean, there's a chapter on Amiga DOS and AVRX, is a chapter on CinemaWare and Psygnosis. The chipsets all get their
own
chapter.
This is from the MIT Press. This is serious stuff.
It's awesome.
There's a whole chapter on Boeing.
Yeah. Well, the Boeing demo, the original Boeing demo.
Yeah, but
incredible.
A chapter?
Absolutely. So, but here's the thing that's really amazing
about
this. Absolutely. And I remember this very well. We were still living in Boston before we had moved to Phoenix. My wife had an amazingly anemic IBM PS1 computer. This thing could display four shades of gray. It was a 286 with maybe 1 megabyte of RAM. It was an absolute piece of crap. I used to go to this Amiga dealership. I was friends with the owner. I had a kind of a tricked out Amiga 500 at the time, and yada, yada, yada. And the Amiga was very big with two things. Video, which is described in the book. It was basically just a mistake, because originally it was going to be a game machine that would be attached to TVs. But, you know, for the Amiga, new tech and the video toaster was to that platform what desktop publishing was to the Mac. It gave it a new lease on life. But the other thing it was good at was sideways scrollers. For whatever reason, the way that you could program this thing, you could do like parallax scrolling and, you know, sideways scrollers, Shadow of the Beast, whatever. Those types of things were great. But one day I showed up at this dealership and he had a game for DOS machines called Doom. It wasn't Doom. It was Castle Wolfenstein, Return to Castle Wolfenstein. And he says, listen to me, if you have a PC, you have to bring this home and try this thing. It's unbelievable. And I thought, well, this is going to be a joke, because my wife's computer is a joke and I have an Amiga, and the Amiga is this incredible multimedia wonder. And I brought it home, and that thing, even on my wife's horrible computer, and even though it was in four shades of gray, it flew. It just flew. And this was a wake-up call for me, because they never really made games like that for the Amiga. They did later on, but this was an area where the Amiga's traditional strengths kind of betrayed it, because what was happening on the PC and the Mac side is that just the raw horsepower of the chipsets were going up and up and up. And so even my wife's lowly 286 had enough processing power to do a first-person 3D game that flowed very well and worked very, very well, and made my Amiga look stupid by comparison. And that was really the death knell for that platform, because it was always pushed as, like, you know, multimedia games and all that kind of stuff. And that was really kind of the moment where it all fell apart. And I remember actually thinking that exact same thing. Like, this was, it was a wake up call, you know. And if you like technology at all, obviously if you like the Amiga in particular, it's a must read. But, you know, we try to, I try a lot to find good Audible books that are based around technology. There are some, even just in the general world of books about technology. There are only really a handful of titles that I can wholeheartedly recommend. This one is it's amazing. And it's by the same, it's not the same author, but the other book in this series, I think, is called Riding the Beam, which is a similar take on the Atari 2600, a similar look at the technical aspects of the Atari 2600 and how those games were made, how they overcame the technical limitations of the 4K, you know, cartridge and all that kind of stuff. And so there's another book like this too. I mean, and I think there'll be more in the future, but this is just a, it was just an amazing, I don't want to call it life altering. I mean, I love the Amiga and I always will. And this was just an amazing, I can't believe somebody wrote this now. It's amazing. So you really have to, if you love technology at all, again, if you love the Amiga too, you have to read this. It's amazing.
And of course, Wolfenstein was the first game with speaking characters.
Yeah.
Oh, mein Leben.
I imagine the sound was better on the Amiga than it was on the Apple II. On the Apple II, it was basically...
Well, I'm talking about the 3D version, you know, the id version.
Oh, yeah, the Wolfenstein 3D. Yeah, the original was...
Yeah. No, I mean, and again...
But that was good. I was, you know, we were impressed.
Remember, it could run a demo. It would sit there and run around. A guy would run around the level.
Such a great game.
And I'm looking at this on my wife's computer. You couldn't do anything on this. You know, Windows was so slow, it would draw... In real time, the menus.
So it was the games, even then, it was the games that attracted you.
Yep.
Isn't that interesting? Paul Thurrott has a book to do, so we're going to let him go.
Okay.
Get writing, Paul!
Sorry, I don't mean to be such a slouch.
And I ain't talking the Delphi 3 Super Bible. No, no. Which I do have on the shelf here. I'm talking about...
Who doesn't, Leo?
Who doesn't? Windows 8 Secrets. Which ain't secret no more. You think it'll be a 1,000-pager? Wait a minute, I got to get the Delphi.
No, we're going to keep it. You've got to see this thing. 650 is where we're going to keep it.
This thing. Oh, I can't even lift it.
See, that book's, like, I bet that book is not 1,000 pages long.
Of course, you had three other people writing this with you. You didn't write the whole thing.
Well, Leo, as is so often the case with the books that I co-author, I, in fact, wrote almost all of them.
Oh, just somebody else's name is on here for no reason. I won't say their names.
Oh, no, no. I'm sure they did.
They did something. 1,312 pages, and that wasn't enough, so they put a CD in the back.
Yeah.
That's how important. This is my most cherished tome.
Me too. Well, by the way, so I...
Paul's Blood, Sweat, and Tears is in there.
Well, but there's some continuity between this book and what's happened with Microsoft. Because the guy, you know, Borland's platform of sorts was Pascal, right? They did Turbo Pascal.
Yeah, Delphi is basically Turbo Pascal, right?
It's Object Pascal.
Object Pascal.
But it's not just that Object Pascal. It's Object Pascal plus the VCL frameworks. That was their SDK. It was their... Object Pascal version of MFC, if you will. It was a set of beautiful APIs.
And that's mostly what this book is a list of all the APIs.
It's an API reference, yeah. So here's the thing. The guy that wrote that, the guy that wrote the VCL, the guy that wrote Object Pascal, Anders Heilsberg, hired by Microsoft, he did .NET. And so this is the guy who's responsible for the .NET frameworks and for the C# programming language. So this stuff basically carried on, if you will, sort of, as a C variant called C#, and as the .NET frameworks, and then everything that's come out of the .NET frameworks, including WPF and Silverlight.
Well, I had no idea. That's very interesting.
And NRT, absolutely. So this was the beginning of... Delphi is almost a reaction to how horrible C++ and the MFC was.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating, actually. But a good API lives forever. As does the book.
Delphi is still around.
It is, and a lot of people still use it.
As is the VCL, I'm sure.
Yeah. Paul's book is now Windows 8 Secrets. He's working on it now. It'll be out day and date with Windows 8. Ooh, that rhymes. He's also, of course, the guy in charge at the Supersite for Windows, winsupersite.com. And you must go there. A lot of what we've talked about is fully elucidated on the website. Don't forget, Mary Jo Foley will be back. She writes the All About Microsoft column for ZDNet at allaboutmicrosoft.com. And next week she shall return. Paul, I'm going back to the world of Diablo, but
I will join you when it comes onto the Xbox 360.
You know, it's such a fun game. You played the original, right?
I did. Yeah.
So you know, Then now you can have people in your party. So I've got a Templar.
This is more. So this is not completely top down. It's kind of at an angle.
Yeah, but you can't. You know, a lot of times you could zoom up and down, and so you can't do any of that stuff.
Yeah, obviously the graphics are only a million times better.
It is, but the gameplay is surprisingly similar. I mean, like I said, there are some differences.
You don't screw around with success. There's no reason to.
Right.
Yeah. Right. But I remember. You click on where you want to go, and it kind of follows you.
Yeah. Now I'm in all Karnas. And this is stuff that they dropped. I don't pick it up because it's crap. And now
the discerning dungeoneer.
The discerning. Well, you know, it's funny because Chad came in, my producer, and said, "Hey, Leo, pro tip: don't pick up that stuff. It's not worth it. It's worth 2 coins when you get back. Yeah, just pick up magic items. Yeah, pick up magic items. That's all you need." So I've killed Magda, and now I'm returning to the hidden camp. Ooh, that was a scorpion I stepped on.
You just stepped in dog mess.
I know. It makes a sound when you step. Watch, I'll step on another one. See? Ooh. Yuck. Oh, and then there's dead people everywhere. And mostly they just contain gold. Sure. So, yeah. So it's fun. You're gonna enjoy this. I'm in the desert. This is Act 2, the desert
I'm
portion.
I'm surprised they took so long to do this.
It took 10 years, right? Something like that.
Yeah. Seems a little more effectively done than, say, the most recent Duke Nukem game.
There's a little more thought into it,
you know.
And then you, sometimes you'd find little books. As
Uriel is the twin of Andariel. I believe that.
And then the guy who sat. This is Deckard Cain. He's back, and he still sounds like Sean Connery.
Somewhere there's a guy wearing a Gandalf hat playing this game right now.
The Lord of Pain was found guarding. You know what I'm saying? The tomb of
Tal-Amarsh. Paul, thank you. It's always a pleasure. I'm so glad to be back. And I missed you, and we will see you next week. We do this show every Thursday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That would be 1800 UTC on twits.tv. But, you know, we make audio and video available after the fact, always on our website, twit.tv/WW for Windows Weekly. See you next time, Paul.